Hello everybody and welcome to the dinner panel. My name is Andrew Charlton and I'm joined by three panelists who need no introduction. Because you know them all so well, I'm going to try my best to tell you something about them that you might not know. On my left, Guy DeBell, Deputy Governor of the RBA and also a former popular DJ in the Canberra area. Round of applause for DJ Guy. On my right, David Groon, head of the ABS, but also G20 Sherpa, who was accosted, sanctioned for illegal swimming at a G20 event. And Danielle Wood, not only the CEO of the Grattan Institute, but also a former card counter at the Adelaide Casino. Please welcome your guests. The format of this session is we're going to ask each of the panellists to speak for 5 minutes and then take questions from the floor. I might start to get the panel kicked off with an observation and a question. The observation would be that today we had a very interesting set of discussions around the digital economy. And you know, one of the themes that came very strongly out of that discussion is that we don't measure the digital economy as well as we might. But the question that I want to pose is, before we get to the question of how do we measure the digital economy and could we do it better, can we spend some time thinking about the what? What is the digital economy? How do we define it? And I think there's a lot of different definitions of the digital economy out there. There'd be maybe some people 10 years ago who would have defined the digital economy in terms of a handful of companies. There might be some people who define the digital economy according to a set of ANZIC codes. There might be some who think about the digital economy much more broadly, being a component of what every firm does. On the labour market as well, I think there are lots of different ways to think about the digital economy. You can think about tech workers as being workers who work for tech companies. You can think about tech workers as being workers in a prescribed set of ANSCO codes. Or you can think about, as Angela spoke to us about today, technology being a part of everybody's job, imbued in the tasks that they do, whether they are a hairdresser or a software engineer. I think this question of how we define the digital economy matters. It doesn't matter to the sense that we need a single answer, but I think it matters in the sense that the way you think about the digital economy has an impact on important questions like how you measure the digital economy, how you think about the performance of the digital economy, and how you think about some of the potential policy responses in the digital economy. Just starting with that thought about measurement and performance, depending on the way that you define the digital economy, Australia is either right at the bottom of the OECD in terms of our performance in the digital economy. If you think just about those limited set of ANZIC code, ANZIC industries, that some people use to describe a shorthand for the digital economy, Australia's share of value added in those industries is very small, right at the bottom of the OECD. If you think about embodied technology in some of our industries, like mining and agriculture, we are in a much broader definition of technology. We are on some measures much closer to the top. It matters, I think, as well in skills and in the labour market. Think about quite a narrow definition of the digital economy, then we have really severe skill shortages as measured by vacancy rates. If you think about a much broader definition of the digital economy, a much wider set of occupations, actually those vacancy rates are pretty much around the national average. For my 2 cents worth, I think there are lots of policy questions which lend themselves to a much broader sense of what the digital economy is. Dan Andrews, who's here, and I did some work last year using data from Xero, anonymized data from the small business accounting platform Xero, looking at digital adoption during COVID. And we saw a huge response from not tech businesses, not big businesses, but from very small businesses in Australia to COVID in terms of technology adoption. The remarkable thing about this data is you can see the firm's P&L. So you can see their expenditure on ICT. And we saw a 13% increase in Australian firms' expenditure on ICT amongst small firms. And we also saw like that those firms that invested more in ICT were more resilient through the crisis. I think there are lots of reasons for us to think broadly about the digital economy, but to be mindful when we're thinking about measurement or thinking about policy, what do we mean when we talk about the digital economy? And so first I'm going to ask Danielle to give us her thoughts on these matters.
And he says that because he doesn't know what I'm going to say yet. And actually, no one knows what I'm going to say because when I raised what I thought I was going to say, everyone looked a bit horrified. So I'm keeping it... I was going to go into all sorts of scary policy issues, but I'm actually going to keep it much more sanguine, but hopefully still raise some interesting points. But I thought, you know, I'm coming to this event as someone from outside government, but someone who's very passionate about policy and evidence-based policy. So I wanted to just make some reflections on, you know, what I think are the really exciting opportunities here, but what I also see is some of the challenges to realising that vision that we've been talking about today of really data-driven policy getting adopted. So first on the opportunities. So I always say to my staff and my potential staff, like, there is no more exciting time to be an economist in the policy world than right now. And certainly, if I compare to when I started in the profession 20 years ago, the tools and the data sets that we have available to answer important questions have really grown exponentially. Mm. So I did want to recognise particularly David and the ABS and others as well. I think the making available the linked administrative data sets is a game changer. Like I think this is a potentially sort of transformative moment for policy. So to give you just a couple of examples, 2 days ago, Grattan put out some work on out-of-pocket health costs. We can see in the headline data they've grown substantially over the past decade. We're interested in why and who's paying them. So what we can see using the made-up data is low-income people are disproportionately hit, people with chronic conditions, and we can also see where it's coming from. It's a tale of specialists that are charging three times the schedule fee. So that allows us to answer policy questions we couldn't answer before and to craft better policy solutions. So I think that's incredibly exciting. The other reason I think it's exciting is because I've been sort of personally shocked at how few Australian academics are interested in doing work on Australian policy. And obviously we have some very notable exceptions in this room and we had them on the VCU today as well. But I think one of the barriers is just we haven't had the cool data sets to ask the kind of questions that academic economists that are really empirically driven like to ask. And so I'm really hopeful that is really going to be a shift in the paradigm. And I do see that as really complementary to what I know is the kind of excellent work going on within the public service on these data sets right now. So those are the opportunities. I've got four potential sticking points. One, I think the data culture within public service still has some way to go. And I think, you know, David has been leading the way with his enthusiasm in terms of making this data available, but we've still faced challenges in terms of getting every agency whose data you want to use to sign off in a timely way. And to me, really good policy analysis is nimble. Often you're responding to a question that's very timely, and so being able to turn this around and know that you can get approvals to do things quickly is really important. Second is how receptive decision makers and the public are to this type of analysis. So I was really heartened today to hear about what people perceive to be the shift post-COVID, the kind of recognition of the value of expertise and the recognition of the way data has helped shape the COVID response. But I think we do need to be wary that we can easily slip back into the world pre-COVID. And I think there was a period where there was a real skepticism of experts. The famous, it was Michael Gove line, you know, we've had enough of experts. Mm. But, you know, there was kind of a general sense of declining interest in expertise and all the kind of data stuff that goes along with that. So I think it's incumbent on all of us to be really good at the storytelling with data to kind of bring people along with us. Third is, how do we deal with the growth in bad analysis? So as we get more data, there's also going to be a lot more, I think, questionable kind of black box modeling that goes on. You know, good old days, we would just see people misusing the input-output tables and everyone kind of knew what was going on. But nowadays, there are much more complex models. And I think it's really hard. It's hard for the public. It's hard for the politicians. It's hard even for the public servants with the expertise to pull apart what's happened. And I think it really matters because it can shape the public debate. So I think back to debates around negative gearing. You know, one piece of questionable modelling, there was one piece of work that suggested, you know, a $2 billion tax change was going to wipe $20 billion off GDP. Like, totally, you know, doesn't meet any sense check. Yet it runs on the front page of the national newspaper. It's quoted in Parliament. It's tweeted by the Treasurer. It effectively derails a policy discussion. So I think there's interesting questions about how we deal with that. I've spoken to Treasury before. I'm not sure how excited anyone is about this idea except for me, but I would love to see something like a code of conduct for modelling. A lot of state governments have it for cost-benefit analysis. And I'm talking really basic stuff here. Have you been transparent about your key assumptions? Have you detailed your methodology? And if it's produced by a consulting firm, have you had the partners that are accountable for the quality put their names to the piece of work? You know, these are very basic checks and balances. Mm. Public service could demand it for work done for them, and it provides us some guardrails for third-party pieces of modelling. Finally, sorry, I'm probably going way over time here. How do we attract good people with these skills into policy making? I think universities are increasingly producing people with more and more data skills, and that's brilliant. We spoke a bit today about how they're quite attracted to, you know, going to the tech companies, and I've certainly observed that. I think companies which have exciting proprietary data sets are attractive to these people. But my observation is many of them are really enthusiastic about policy and they actually want to be doing this kind of really interesting policy work. So I think public service agencies have a huge opportunity. First, you need to give people the tools. So whenever I've had data scientists that have left and gone to the public service, if they have a complaint, it's, I couldn't use R because, you know, it wasn't seen as secure. You know, that is insane. If you're hiring someone who that is their skill set, they need to have the tools. Or my computer wasn't fast enough, or I couldn't do, you know, so give people the tools. But second of all, they have to be doing the meaty policy work. So the thing that really concerns me is that if we see increasingly work getting shunted off to the consultants and the really interesting, important work, we're going to lose the capacity to attract those people into the public service. So I think that, you know, really needs consideration because these people will be the future and they're going to be hopefully driving this next wave of policy making that I'm talking about. Thank you.
Thanks, Danielle. David.
Thanks, Andrew. So about a year ago, we were thinking about running a conference on the economics of the digital economy because we thought it was a topic that was that was worthy of more attention. And Michael Smeads, who has been very influential in organising this conference, said, well, you know, what are we going to do? And I said, well, I'm having dinner with Guy Debelle in a couple of days, so why don't I pitch to him the idea that maybe the RBA could do it jointly with us? And Guy jumped at the opportunity, so I'm very grateful to the RBA for hosting us here in their training college in Kirribilli. And we had a kind of new idea, which was we might run a panel in the middle of dinner, and we thought about who do we want on this panel, and I thought, wouldn't it be good if we could get Andrew Charlton to moderate it? So I sent Andrew an email, and he said, sure. He didn't even know who was on the panel, I think, when he agreed, which was good. And I thought, Guy should definitely be on it, because Guy's always got good things to say. And I definitely, the fourth person, I was going to be on it. The fourth person, that went without saying. And the fourth person who I wanted to be on the panel was Danielle. So I'm extremely grateful for the other people who I asked that they agreed to be on the panel. And this is a bit of an innovation. And if it goes well, when we run other conferences, we'll do something else. And the question is whether I'm going to continue to have a batting average of 100%. But we'll put that aside as something for the future. Now, Andrew has done many things in his life, but he was at one point a G20 Sherpa. I just don't have any stories about what he got up to, so I won't share them with you. Okay, so now we've talked a fair bit today, and we'll talk some more tomorrow about the kind of difficulties that measurement throws up, and obviously they're pretty central for the concerns of the ABS. And we talked a bit earlier today about what progress we could make in terms of measuring the gig economy, and there I think we can definitely make significant progress, and the government's funded us to look at that more carefully. And I talked a bit about that today, about the fact that we're going to do this obviously in concert with our international partners, because we want it to be part of the labour force survey, and we want those questions to be internationally comparable. So I think on finding out more about gig workers and finding out the circumstances in which they work, the extent to which they're second jobs or third jobs, I think the news is good. I think it's a matter of nailing down the questions and getting kind of agreement, but I don't think those issues are insurmountable at all. And I'm looking forward to kind of making progress on that. Trying to get this stuff into the national accounts is obviously a order of magnitude more difficult. As Michael said, the latest national account system dates back to 2008, hence it's called SNA 08. And the update presently being worked on is due to go before the UN in 2025. So there's a big gap between one update of the national accounts and the next one, right? 2008 to 2025. There's going to be an attempt to at least clarify a whole bunch of many of the issues that we're kind of been grappling with. So the update aims to clarify the treatment of free products, record and value free products in a satellite account, work out how to deal with digital intermediary platforms, and include data in the scope of the new SNA. But for those people who were here for Michael Smead's paper, this is no easy task, right? I mean, there are conceptual difficulties about how you treat data. Is it an asset, or is it something that gets used in the production process? If some things may have a long life, but clearly the data that Google Maps gets from you about the traffic, about how long it's taking you to drive down a road, that's useful for about an hour, because it's going to be overridden by somebody else's data. It doesn't mean it's not useful. It's incredibly useful, and I'm extremely happy to share my data with Google Maps because it's. But these are issues that are genuinely hard, not only in terms of measurement, but also in terms of trying to fit it into the current frameworks. And then, if I can put a pitch in for Kevin Fox's paper tomorrow, attempting to come up with estimates of what people value these free products at, some of these estimates are enormous. And it's kind of interesting. Now, free products are not, the digital economy is not the only place where there are free products, but it is a source of quite a lot of them. And some of the estimates that Kevin puts forward in his paper suggest that this stuff is really valuable for people. So we have to work on these measurement issues, but there are some that are kind of clearly manageable and others that are an order of magnitude more difficult. Okay, I want to conclude with an issue that I think has come to the fore with the huge rise in the quantity and quality of data sets generated by the private sector as a consequence of the digitalization of their businesses. And that issue is the enormous public value that can be generated by appropriate public use of these private sector assets. Let me give an example. This is just one example, but I'm pitching something that we've just done. We have a new household consumption indicator, which we first published last month, and we're going to be publishing monthly. It uses de-identified aggregated data from the major banks, at the moment, the only monthly indicator of household consumption is the retail trade survey, which covers about 30% of the national accounts measure of household consumption, which is the household final consumption expenditure. So retail trade covers 30%. With this de-identified aggregated data from the banks, we can cover 68% of household consumption. So, with time, we'll be able to raise that even further. And obviously, we can reduce the burden on the people we ring up, we hassle to answer the retail trade survey. We're not about to end the retail trade survey, but that's on our agenda. That once we've kind of got this indicator up and running, and we're comfortable with it, and we've got enough data, we've got a long enough run of data that it's kind of settled down, then we will think about getting rid of the retail trade survey. So this private sector data, which has been collected for firms' legitimate commercial interests, but they're not data firms, they're banks in this case. The proposition that I want to put forward is that I think as part of their broad social responsibility to the community, big firms with data assets that they've collected for their own purposes. I think we need to think about the extent to which they have a responsibility to share that with the public sector, with appropriate privacy and security safeguards. But I think it's worth thinking about, to the extent that can generate public value, what are going to be the commercial arrangements between private sector firms that have big valuable data assets and the public sector. So let me end there.
I think just on that point, there's not only an externality in the use of companies' data, but individual data as well. There's some social value beyond the private value, which we are at risk of not unlocking with our current framework.
Yeah.
Guy.
Thanks. So I'm not sure what territory is left after those two, but I'm going to try and head into some other territory. But one thing I want to come back to is the measurement. So at a conceptual level, I find it interesting. So some of you may know of Jeff Harcourt, who just died last month, and I actually had the privilege of sort of coordinating a testimony to Jeff at Adelaide Uni last month. So Jeff famously was a major protagonist in the two Cambridges debate. And that's actually, and that was in sort of through the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
And it's actually directly relevant to the questions we're talking about now. Not they have obviously, you know, not digital technology wasn't a thing then, but it was about technology. And the Cambridge debate, the two Cambridges debate, so the two Cambridges are Cambridge, England, and the wrong Cambridge, which is the one I went to, which is Cambridge, Massachusetts, which according to Jeff was the losing Cambridge in the Cambridge debate.
Well, he was from the other Cambridge.
Yes, he was, and he always claimed victory over but it was really, a lot of it is about measurement of capital. So this is about capital more generally, of which data is and digital assets is a thing. But it was really about, well, to some extent, the Cambridge England aspect of it, it's really about the embodied labor. And if you think about the capital is all about the embodied labor, and they thought it was always a very false distinction that you have between capital and labor. And actually this applies in this space as well, because yeah. In the end, actually, this is becoming, maybe this is not quite so true now, but in the end, it's all generated by someone doing something. Now, with machine learning, that's maybe starting to push the boundaries of that, but the sort of Cambridge, England debate was actually, you can always boil, everything is reducible down to the labor input into something. Mm-hmm. As I said, slightly more challenging concept now with the concept of machine labor, and maybe once we hit the singularity, it'll be a completely moot discussion. But anyway, I do actually think it's interesting, having just spent a bit of time rereading some of the Cambridge controversies, that actually it's the same conceptual issue that we're now starting, confronting now. And then now I'm going to go and just invoke someone who from the wrong Cambridge that I went to, who's pretty famous in this space, which was Bob Solow,
yeah.
And just repeat a few things that Bob said. Luckily took a class from him. So Bob, obviously one of the more famous ones, quotes of his, which is relevant in this space, is that the computer revolution is evident everywhere except in the data. And that's actually, to some extent, the issue we're dealing, or to a large extent, the issue we're dealing with today, is that we can see all of this stuff around, and it's clearly there, but we just can't see it in the data. And then Bob's case, so if you go back to Bob's original article, he has this plot about productivity growth, and there are three outliers in the, and he says, well, one plausible explanation of why these three outliers are there is because the data's wrong, turns out. That was indeed the answer. It's probably simplifying something for which you won a Nobel Prize down to something a little too simple. But anyway, that's sort of roughly the point. And I think so when we're thinking about productivity growth and issues like and technological change, and it comes to your point about where Australia ranks in some of these global comparisons, Andrew, is that we're making that assessment on data which is not necessarily suitable. And that brings me on to now I am going to invoke my GJ career. So one of the shows that I used to have on 2XX in Canberra was called Know Your Product, and that's very much what we need to be aware of here. Is we need to know your products, we need to know the product we have now. But we also need, when we're going and getting these other data sets from all these other people, is we need to know what that product is as well. And I think one thing we have to be cognizant of and a risk we have to avoid is basically saying that what's measured is real, and if it's not measured, it's not real, and or it doesn't matter. And we're recognizing at the moment that we have these gaps in measurement, but just because we can access a data set for something, that makes that real. But if there's a whole bunch of other stuff that we can't easily access data, that doesn't mean that it's not real. Even including in the sort of real GDP concept, to sort of give it a statistical point. And I suppose that brings me on to the next thing which I was going to invoke, which is relevant to this, is the ability to extract signal from noise. In the data, and Nate Silver, who we were talking about at dinner a bit earlier, has his book on signal versus noise, and on 538, which is now Nate's main way of communicating with the rest of the world, they have this segment quite regularly called "Good Use of Polling, Bad Use of Polling," and they put out, here's a survey, here's the question they ask: is that good use of polling, bad use of polling? And I actually think that's a question which needs to be asked of the data. Is this good use of data or bad use of data? So when someone's gone out and collected this data, is this good collection of data, bad collection of data? And I think one point which comes out in your paper, Mark, is the framing of the way the question is asked actually really matters. So you can get the data, but how was the question asked? How was the question framed, which generated that data? And that actually really matters. Now you, I think, in the whole system of national accounts, have had a whole long history of thinking about how those questions should be appropriately asked to generate the concepts that you actually want to measure. Hmm. When you go out and talk to and access these private data collections, they haven't had that same motivation,
sure,
in asking those questions. I assume they're mostly asking those questions as to what is the question I can most monetize, or the answer to the question that I can most monetize. Maybe that gives you the same answer, but maybe it doesn't. And I think, so when we're accessing all these other data sets which haven't been generated with the same diligence and rigor that the system of national accounts has been generated, then I think that's something we certainly need to be cognizant of. And then I suppose the other point, which sort of was touched on in some of the comments you made, David, and is evident in at least what I took from your paper, Michael, is, you know, this whole issue about there's A, the non-exclusivity of data, of some data, not all data, but non-exclusivity. So once you put it in, so if I'm a private sector company, I've generated this data, and then you, ABS, comes along and says, well, I'd like to use that, thanks very much, and then actually that makes that data then readily available to all my competitors who hadn't bothered to get off their asses and collect this data. That's an interesting question to be contemplated. Secondly, there's the whole network benefit aspect of it, which the tech companies are, I suppose, the most clear embodiment of, that, you know, the network externalities really matter, and that if I get in front in that space, and one of the ways I might get in front is because the ABS happily uses my data, that may give me a bit of an extra kicker, then, you know, then I get to really benefit from those network benefits, and maybe that's the way you incentivize people to do it. But there is a sort of winner takes all aspect to it, that once you get in front with the network benefits, you tend to stay in front and move further in front. And then I think there's also the issue, which is the sort of large option value of data. So we have these companies collecting, my sense is that we have a lot of companies collecting data and they don't actually know what the value of the data that they're collecting is. They may have collected it for one particular purpose, but actually there's a whole latent option value of that data sitting there, which they're not able to realize. And actually, potentially, with the ABS working with them, they may be able to actually see there's a hell of a lot more option value that's been able to that's realizable from that data. And so, how do you deal with that from a sort of public policy point of view, if you're basically unleashing that for them and they get all the benefits from that? Is that the way you wanted to, things to fall? Or should, as you're working with them in refining the data, making it more usable from your side, but at the same time making it more usable for them, do you want to be retaining some of that potentially realizable value of that data? So, I think, there's a hell of a lot of opportunity out there with all this access to all this data that we potentially have now, and the way that the public sector can capitalize on it. And I, completely agree with what Danielle said about, evidence-based policy based on all this data has surely got it. Whatever it's got to be, it's got to be a hell of a lot better than policy based not on evidence. But in doing so, I think so that's absolutely got to be the end objective. But I think there are as you're interacting with the private sector in accessing all the value in this data, I think there's some pretty interesting questions that come up along the way. So they're just some of the ones which came to my mind.
Good. Terrific. Thank you. Well, we're going to take some questions from the floor, so please have your questions ready. I might get started with a question to David. David, as you, I'm taking you into your world as the head of statistical agencies, and when you're engaging with your counterparts around the world in what, at least in my mind, are very salubrious events, when you look at practices around the world, who do you think does this well? What do you think we can learn from? Are there examples out there of other countries who deal with some of the issues that Guy was talking about? Get the incentives right, get the structures right, to delivering things that should be markers for us to look forward to. What's the best practice out there?
That's a good question. I think one of the differences between countries is, I think probably the arrival of the pandemic meant that a lot of statistical agencies started looking at the possibility of kind of alternative sources of data. Mm. and mobility data, is plenty of them have gone for mobility data, telecom data. So there's a wide range of practices, and I'm not confident I know what best practice is, because this is moving so quickly. And people are, I think, learning from each other, but we're, I mean, I think in some ways we're doing things that other countries are not doing, but then there are other kind of things that others are doing. And it's partly the legal environment that statistical agencies find themselves in. What can they do? But I guess that what I'm impressed by is the fact that there's been a lot of commonality in terms of a sprint to try and find new data sources and provide closer to real-time information about what's going on. And we're certainly part of that. But I wouldn't want to pick any particular country as being kind of in the vanguard. Mm-hmm. Although the minister suggested this morning that it was Estonia, though he then said, but not necessarily. So he wasn't going to commit to that.
Well, it's certainly this, you know, the work that the ABS did in this crisis, has been said today, was a huge step on from the work, the data available to the government in the last crisis. I remember I worked in the Prime Minister's office during the last crisis. And one of my counterparts and very good friends is a fellow called Lachlan Harris, who you'll remember at the time as the Prime Minister's senior press secretary. And Lachlan's family owns Harris Farm. So our version of real-time data during the GFC was Lachie calling up his dad and saying, how are the tills running today? So you're just doing a slightly more sophisticated version of that, really, Dave. I think we had a question over here.
Yeah, and you've also got Mark
back there. And Mark, yeah. So we'll do Dan and then Mark.
Mark go first, but I don't want you in
here.
Mark.
Thanks, Dan.
Okay. Hi. So David started off the conference today by giving a story about the world's largest companies 25 years ago. So 25 years ago, I was in the British Civil Service. I was working British Civil Service. I was working 2 days a week at home. I was using the internet and email to do my work with my colleagues in London. So I'm kind of wondering, in one sense, how much has changed. But I'm kind of also wondering, have we really, you know, we were talking at that stage maybe about the information economy rather than the digital economy. Have we advanced our understanding over the last 25 years? Or are we, to quote another Saints song, given Guy did one, I'm stranded. Have we advanced our understanding over the last 25 years? Or are we still just spinning wheels?
Who's going to answer that?
Well, that's one for the statistics boffins.
I mean, I reckon we've got better data. And so it kind of depends. I mean, what about the stuff that Raj Chetty's doing? Yeah. What about that? Getting big data sets and applying them to micro problems and working out who it is in, So I think it's messier. Because plenty of these data sets, as I think Guy said, have not been designed with a specific purpose that they're now being dragooned into. So they've been designed for some other purpose. But I think the granularity and the extent and the real time, the fact that it's much closer to real time, I think the to make another example, the policymakers in the COVID crisis had a much better handle on what was going on in the labour market than the policymakers, of whom Andrew was one and I was another in a different entity, for the global financial crisis. So I think we have got a much better information base. And then I think I'll let Danielle answer, but I think the promise of administrative data is that you'll be hopefully able to get a much better handle on microeconomic problems than we've had in the past.
Absolutely. I think that's it's clear that now, I think when people started to get excited about data, often they were driven by, the questions were driven by what data sets were available, right? So they were like, I've got this data set on ride sharing, so I'm going to ask this particular question. I think the exciting thing about administrative data sets is you can actually start with the policy question you want to ask, and now the data is sitting there to allow you to answer that very specific question. So I think that is a real game changer. I think you might have been ahead of your time 25 years ago. Certainly the data suggests not many people were working from home on the internet at that point in time. Now a lot are, and I think, as I said, the tools and the information that we have at our fingertips is dramatically different.
There's sort of measurement without theory, right? And I think a lot of the data before now has been measurement without theory. So actually the advantage of getting you guys, the ABS, involved in it is actually you're providing the theory ahead of, not ahead of the measurement, the measurement's still there, but actually providing the theory to guide the measurement. And I completely agree with Danielle. There's, a lot of my peers in grad school, the way you did your thesis, which you found some funky data set, which no one, basically it was just find the data set. Actually, that was how you did your thesis. And it didn't really matter what question you asked, as long as you found a data set which someone else hadn't found before, and then you just did, that would do it. Whereas now it's actually, no, I actually want to answer this question, and so what data do I bring to bear on that question? That's quite a different way of doing it. So the constraint before was the existence of the data. Now the constraint, which is the appropriate constraint, is what's the question you want to answer?
I used data from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, the game show, for my thesis, which shows you how desperate I was to find a cool data set.
Dan.
Thanks. So obviously, Danielle, you picked up that we've kind of had a good crisis, right, in terms of data. I think that's true. I would say, though, that there was a bit of a sort of a forerunner to that. There's a quiet revolution that happened in Australia, right? So, David, obviously, you being appointed to the ABS head was a game changer. But I think back to the days of DIPA, right? The Data Integration Platform of Australia, which, Mark mentioned before, the Blade data set, which was set up. The reality of DIPA is it reallocated a lot of money to Treasury to actually set up a gun applied micro data team, which could then be spun behind real-time data analysis during the crisis. So I think it's true that we've done well, but there was movement before that,
and it's true.
And there was, that fight was often bitter. And everyone who talks about evidence-based policy in the public service, only a couple of them show up when it matters, right? So my question is, in say 10 years time, when we have the next economic crisis, or whenever it is, right? Guy, you may be governor.
It might be tomorrow, but the next guy, economic crisis.
How do we actually keep going from here? Right? What do we need? What would be the one piece of data that each of you'd want to actually improve decision making? Because what I worry about, right, is that, okay, things calm down. David retires, does whatever he wants, maybe joins E61.
I've got it off for you afterwards, please.
We go back to the old habits, and then boom, all of a sudden, financial crisis hits. All of a sudden, we don't have firms and banks linked together, and that takes a long time to do. So how do we keep this going, right? Like, let's get real here for a second. And, David, I've got a split personality when it comes to data integration in Australia, you know this, and I'm sort of giving the ABS credit now, but there is a history here, right, where not a lot happened over a long period of time, right? So how do we actually keep this going so that the next time we get a big shock, we can actually, have like actually policy that's guided by evidence like we've had during this crisis?
Good question.
So what are the next steps? Can I have a go for it? So it's not obvious to me, Dan, that it's actually, so you're basically asking more about what I would loosely describe as macro data. Not obvious to me that actually where the ABS should be committing resources. So I could think, it's plausible that actually there are, and maybe it's, but you do have a budget, I think you do have a budget constraint, David.
We do. But,
So.
I don't know, print money.
Laptop.
So, no, But the serious point I want to make is, you know, I think we've got to actually think, you know, most of us are probably economists, so we've got to think about it as an economic, as economists, right? So we have scarce resources to allocate to this problem. So what is the data that we feel is going to be most consequential? Not obvious to me that the answer to that is better macro data. Might be, but it's not obvious to me that it's actually that. I could argue that actually better health data and giving people access to that may be a better, a more appropriate use of public sector funds. So I'm not going to answer your question, Dan, because I think the answer isn't at all obvious, but it's actually a pretty important question. And it partly comes to the point I was saying earlier. It's like, just because the data exists doesn't mean that that's where I should be throwing the money. I think you've got to actually think, what is it? Where is it I feel that could be most consequential? And so if you think back, you mentioned BLADE or longitudinal studies more generally. I mean, one thing about longitudinal studies, you actually got to start them at some point, right? And so there's no point saying, well, that would be nice if we had a long, long time series or long panel series on this. If you haven't thought about it before, you're only going to start collecting that now. But that may be a very, very worthwhile investment to actually start doing that today, so that whatever, you know, but having thought about, well, what sort of questions are I going to be potentially able to answer with those, with that panel data set in some number of, you know, maybe years, decades time. And so I do think I would frame your question slightly differently. I think it's a question of thinking about where do you think the most value add is to be obtained, rather than, and it's, you know, it's not just because I want to deal with the next financial crisis, maybe I want to deal with the next health crisis. Yeah.
Wants to intervene.
I'm happy to answer.
I was just going to offer some, I don't know, counterpoint to this obsession with real-time data.
Yeah, you know, that's where I was going.
The insight that during the GFC was a theoretical one that people already knew, which was we need to pump the money out to people who are going to spend it, and so it goes around. You know, that wasn't something that you truly needed real-time data to do. Yes, you might want to track it and see how well it's going, but that was the thing. And during COVID, it was the understanding of epidemiology and things like that that really should have been driving it, rather than, you know, making it up as you're going along. Because certainly, at least in the economic sphere, it's like there's no reference for this. But if you had, you know, the long-term development of models, which were based on data, but it was historical data, and having all of the access to that, that allowed people to understand how do diseases spread, and what are things that we need to do that are going to restrict that, and fundamentally trusting it, because the lags, even in the real-time data, were so long. So I guess what I'm saying here is, it's not real-time data, it's the capital you build up analyzing the last 10 years of data to understand what really fundamentally drives the economy. And so it's the theory that you need to have developed. And then, yeah, you can use the real-time data to track it, but actually if your theory's good, that's 90% of the battle.
I think I'm a bit more, I'm a bit skeptical about that. I think the real-time data was actually incredibly important here. So you can run all the epidemiological models in the world, but we needed to understand how it was playing out on the ground. So I think the bank transaction data is incredibly important. So that would be my answer to your question. I think it is actually seeing spending, and you know, Alpha Beta was putting out work which we were sort of grasping on, because it was incredibly important to see how it was impacting different sectors. The zero data was important to understand what it was meaning for jobs, the payroll data. So I actually think crafting the policy response does require that understanding of how it's actually playing out on the ground, and I'm not sure your theoretical model can get you there. But just very quickly, I think the other, you know, so I think it's really important that we have access to that data and the capability to use it, and it has to be sitting there. But in preparedness, I would also like more thinking done before the next crisis in terms of actually tailoring the policy response. So my criticism this time around was more that, particularly for sectoral specific supports, we just kind of went back to rolling out construction spending. And that's what we do every, you know, so we can talk about payments or vouchers or, you know, that, but on the business side, like, construction is not the best stimulus. And I think we need to be much more creative about what we do in terms of designing programs. And you can't do that on the spot. You actually have to do the work in advance. So I think there is a lot of preparation we could do. And yes, we'll have to tailor it at the time according to the nature of the crisis, but there's things we can think about now to be ready for the next one.
Yeah. Can I back that up? I think governments were very data hungry in thinking through their policy response. You know, we were talking to governments who were looking for very high granularity regional data to think about different programs. I totally agree with your point that those programs probably didn't have the preparation that would have been even to make them even more effective or to think about what the best policy response was. But I did see a real hunger to use data to inform that process, albeit didn't always get the right outcome. We have a question over here as well.
Thanks very much, and thanks for the panel's observations. I have a question for Danielle, but before I ask it, I just want to say that I really reflect on, you know, the 90s we talked about evidence-based policy making, and then the language shifted slightly to evidence-informed policy making. And I suppose what I'm saying is that whatever evidence or data we have, it also depends on the politics of the situation about the policy that's actually implemented. But my question, Danielle, is to you, completely different, coming from the tertiary sector and trying to stand up for the universities a little bit. I really liked your comment that we want to train and educate our students to be the next generation of people who can make good policy decisions. So it's really a question of the whole panel because, Andrew, I've seen, you know, you're in Accenture now, but the big accounting firms and big consulting firms are taking our students into research. That's where they're going now. How do we encourage them to think about good public service jobs and what training should we do? And I think having access to administrative data is fantastic because I think at the field I work in, now that we can have that, we can start to do some research, really good research. But what should we be doing in the universities to really assist Australia in developing good economists, good policy people, good civil servants?
That's a fantastic question and a huge question. I mean, so I think there's been a really important debate within the economic profession about how we actually teach economics at universities and kind of rather than starting with the models and building up to relaxing the assumptions and asking the interesting questions in year three and year four, flipping on its head and starting with the questions that people go into economics to find out about, like why is there inequality or why did the GFC happen? You know, actually sort of starting with the meaty policy debates, and there's, you know, the core curriculum and others that are actually trying to do that and expose people to that in the early years. And I think actually once you give people the taste of that, they're going to want more. But then I think it's linking it in, and maybe it is through the administrative data sets, linking people into the relevant agencies where they're asking those questions. I think internship programs are fantastic. Certainly at Grattan, we find we get amazing, really policy enthusiastic students coming through. So I think the more agencies do those programs, the more you can expose people. And you know, the accounting firms are good at this, right? Yeah. They're marketing to students, they're offering the internship, that's how they're getting them in, they're creating those pathways. So government agencies need to be competing on the same terms.
I mean, we've been doing that for a little while. and I think that, but so I completely agree with that. But the one thing, to your particular question, so, and I'm gonna pick up, I agree with what you said, Danielle, and so for, this also came up when I was back in Adelaide talking about the way that economics was taught when I went through with Mark. So we had a course in our first year called Economic Institutions and Policy.
Yeah. Wow.
And which was just whatever, and I think there were six different parts across the year. And it was just whatever public policy issue any of the faculty wanted to talk about for, you know, over sort of six half. It shows by mine and Mark's age, at least, you know, it was back in the days of three term years, but, you know, six different modules effectively on a public policy issue. And this was a first year subject, so we'd only, you know, the first first week of this year, hadn't had any other economics except maybe one other lecture. So you're given that straight up, and then the other, and so that actually, and so it's doable. The slight challenge for possibly the university faculty is actually requires a bit of work to put together a coherent course on that. The other one was, I thought, which I think is interesting in some of the in the latter years, in our second year whatever it was called, statistics or econometrics class. So I remember we were probably used as unpaid labor, basically, but the professor who was teaching the course got us to go out and do our own. So we had to go out to supermarket car parks, and we had to sit there and watch people drive past and see if they had seatbelts on in the back seat. So this was in the days, in, at least in South Australia, where that wasn't compulsory. And particularly whether they had their kids in a seatbelt in the back seat, or they were just sitting on their lap in the driver's seat without a seatbelt on. So
what's the point of that story?
The point was, we were answering a, so the, and you don't, you didn't actually realize, you maybe didn't, and you had to write that up as your, as the project in your statistics. So you had to, so you're answering an evident, so it was a policy relevant question. This is whether seatbelts should be compulsory. And this was being, it was it actually right. being commissioned now by the it. South Australian Roads Authority, I'm pretty sure. So it was a policy-based question. You had to go and generate your own data in this case, and then work out what the problems were about the data, and you're answering a policy-based question with data. So you may not have, but so at least if, yeah. So at least if you had that inclination to that was something you're interested in, you're exposed to it quite early on as you're learning all the material. So I think it's actually the exposure. I mean, probably can do that a little more sophisticated these days, but actually getting your hands down and dirty with actually collecting the data is no bad thing either. So I do think that to Danielle's point, I actually think that's actually a pretty important part of it.
And it's good to know that. We're constrained by ethics and student safety. It wasn't a problem back then.
But
sort of examples, but I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
We give them the R code now.
Jason.
So. Okay, sorry. So my question is, I worry about real time data because it has the negative effect of turning politicians into junkies a little bit. How do you recalibrate them to thinking about longer term issues where big data does have some potential benefits, such as climate change, productivity, intergenerational sort of disadvantage? How do we refocus politicians onto those issues?
So
this one's for you.
It's not for me.
You were in the Prime Minister's office. He was focused on all issues, though. So, if he'd had access to the data,
would have slept even less.
Yes.
I think it's a really good question. I think there are lots of politicians who, as you say, are getting more and more interested in the data, and overall, I think that's a really good thing. I think it's sort of a similar question to the question that Danielle posed, which is how do you make sure that this explosion of data doesn't create an explosion of spurious results and an explosion of distractions? I think that goes to some of the thoughts around quality, increasing sophistication of the community that digests and engages with this data. I thought some of Danielle's suggestions were really terrific in terms of ways to lift the standard, and probably some of those are applicable as well. But I think overall it's a good thing that politicians have more data available to them, that there's a sense of accountability out there, that this data will not just be used in policy formulation, but also potentially be used in policy evaluation. And that, that has strong prospects, I think, for the future.
Catherine had a...
Catherine, yes.
My question was about the use of private data.
It's okay, I'm
up. do they need it?
No, it's okay.
It's for the recording.
Yeah.
So when we think about using, say, bank data or supermarket data, do we worry enough about the fact that consumers are responding to incentives as they're creating that data? So for instance, if I'm about to apply for a mortgage loan, I'm going to think very carefully about what I'm spending my money on in my bank account. I'm going to want to look like a very responsible consumer, and my patterns will look different than they might if I wasn't about to apply for a mortgage loan. Or grocery loyalty data, which is awesome, but as soon as the grocery store starts giving people discounts based on patterns in their shopping, that behavior is going to change. They're going to start to, some people are going to think strategically about what they purchase. Are we worrying enough about, you know, if we're using Blade data, people think about what they report on their taxes. They design their investments to minimize their tax burden. Are we thinking hard enough about how incentives are clouding the data that we're using?
I think it depends what question you're trying to answer. So I think I'm not worried about the banking data in the sense that I'm not only using the data of people that are applying for mortgages, I've got a huge data set of everyone's transactions, so I think that's kind of a wash. The customer loyalty, the loyalty card data is interesting, and again, I think, so if I was trying to understand the impact of discounting, you know, elasticities of demand for certain products, that's actually super useful to me, right? That's the kind of variation I want. If I was using it to try and understand consumption patterns in the broad, then I think I would need to be worried about that, the way in which individuals are getting different signals. So I think it's always, I mean, with any data set, it's a matter of understanding the nature of the underlying data set, what you're collecting, and then how that maps to the question that you want to answer. So I think sometimes it's an issue, sometimes not such an issue, and I think we should not pretend that the data that we were using in place of this, the retail survey, was a perfect data set that was free from reporting issues. Like, I think generally this data is better quality because it's individual transaction data. You're actually picking up something real as opposed to surveys which have all sorts of challenging issues.
Yeah. Surely those incentives for misreporting are higher in a survey-based environment than they are in an admin environment. Terrific. Okay, I think please join me in thanking our panelists for a very interesting discussion.